Today is Thursday, June 9th, 2011. This is Susan Resnick continuing to interview President Steven Weber. We had just begun to discuss your experience at San Diego State University. I've read a quote referring to this time at San Diego State as an era of excellence. Would you tell me a little bit about shared vision? I've seen it described as a roadmap for the university's future, and I believe that there are five components. Could you begin?
Yes. Shared vision was really an important part of my coming to San Diego State. In fact, I should say not of my coming to San Diego State, but of beginning my work at San Diego State. I had a friend and colleague who was so confident in the men and women of San Diego State that when I came, he used to say, "Just give us our marching orders." But I was very reluctant to give anybody marching orders because, of course, I didn't know San Diego State, I didn't know San Diego, I didn't know what we were capable of, etc. So I preferred instead to have the campus give me my marching orders. And that's really what we did with Shared Vision. We worked really hard. A lot of professionals pulled together to do it. And we had a year-long conversation on campus that came to be known as Shared Vision. And when I say a year-long conversation, I think they said about, well, over 1,000, maybe even up to 2,000 people were involved. There were two multi-day retreats. There were a number of workshops and working groups, a lot of focus groups that mm-hmm. were then televised across the campus. So the effort was to involve as many people as possible in thinking about the future of San Diego State University. And as it happened, this was a salutary event, and people still talk with me about it today, that it meant a lot to them. I think it was appropriate for San Diego State to sort of reassert its ownership of its own future. Mm-hmm. And if I had come in and simply pronounced what its future was, it would have been my vision. It would have been their vision. And so it was just really good. And people worked hard. They came up with a wonderful sense of who we are and what are the things that are important to us. And it's out of that that then the following 15 years took place. So the first goal was academic excellence. Obviously the heart of any university. The next goal had to do, and I might not have them in the same order that you do, was with our student growth and development and having a whole experience for our students. So, I mean, after all, what universities do is human growth and development. So we wanted a holistic environment for in which our students could grow and prosper and learn. The third one was diversity and social justice. Deep, important values for San Diego State University. The fourth was the internationalization of the campus, and the fifth was the wise use of resources. I mean, those are roughly, mm-hmm. The order might be wrong. And we also said that we would report on these. I mean, as I said, it went through lots of vetting, lots of different things, so we came down to those were the five goals. And then what I said is we would issue a shared vision report every year. And we did that for, I think, 10 or 12 years. And the campus has made extraordinary progress on every one of those goals. And I think that's because they were their goals.
Well, it was a participatory effort.
Absolutely.
And I'm interested, because you said we, tell me about the colleagues you involved, how you involved them.
There's the head of our Counseling and Psychological Services Department was a man named Doug Van Sickle. And Doug was he was very good at involving people and having, understanding ideas of conversation. There were people in his offices that were interested in this project. So we did that. But then, of course, we needed people to chair the committees. Right. We needed people to arrange for the focus groups and the broadcasting of the focus groups. And so, if I remember correctly, there were ultimately about 25 people that were on a sort of central steering committee that uh-huh. worked on different aspects. Because it was a logistically ambitious project. But thanks to their really good thinking through the project you had to sort of say, well, okay, we're going to be together for 2 days. How are we going to divide those 2 days? What are the discussion topics that are going to be out there? How are we going to report on those? How are we going to give everybody else a chance to hear what
right.
what this group said? So with lots of logistical things that had to be thought through.
Oh, I can relate to that. I've been involved in helping do focus groups, and yes. so I understand how that's a mighty
was.
Undertaking. Did you set out on paper goals and objectives or anything like that?
No. In fact, that's it. Other than we wanted a sustained and broad-based campus conversation.
Ah.
That was what we were looking for. In fact, I've often said afterwards that there's nothing terribly surprising about the five goals that we came up with. And it's perfectly possible that you could have put a dozen people in a room for an afternoon and they would have come up with more or less the same goals. The point wasn't the goals, it was the conversation.
I understand. Yeah. The process.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's very interesting. And so for academic excellence, what are some of the things that began to happen?
Well, a lot of things followed from that, but one of the things that's actually quite similar to Shared Vision, because what Shared Vision amounted to was asking the campus what it thought.
Okay.
Well, one of the biggest things that happened on the front of academic excellence, and I need to make clear, this was an excellent university long before I got here, so it wasn't like, let's try excellence. But when I came, I was surprised to find that we were over-enrolled. And we were over-enrolled by about 1,000 students. Now, that's a very unusual thing, because most universities around the country manage their own enrollments. And they basically manage their enrollments consistent with the resources they have to provide services to their students.
Right.
But in the state of California, if a student met the minimum qualifications to come to San Diego State, which were established by the state of California, if they met that and applied to us, they could come. We couldn't turn them away. Oh. They could come. But it didn't follow that the state would fund them. So here we were with 1,000 students that were on our campus and no funds with which to support them. To support those 1,000 students, had there been state funds, it would have cost $7 million to support those students. So what we were faced with was on the one hand, as educators, we like to have students, and we want students to come to San Diego State and be able to study with us. But on the other hand, as educators, we don't want to participate in an academic fraud mm-hmm. in which we admit students, but they can't get courses.
Right.
So that was a question. But as with Shared Vision, what my role was not to answer the question, but to ask the question.
Ah.
So I asked the Senate, which represents the university, to look at this matter and to think about whether they wanted to seek permission to control our enrollments. And the tough choice there, and this also was a year-long conversation held mostly by the Senate, but including large debates in Montezuma Hall and passionate speeches both for and against and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But the issue, as I said earlier, was, well, we want students, but we want students that we can serve.
Yeah.
So I put the question to the Senate. As I said, they worked through it with the campus community, students, faculty, staff, for the better part of a year. And then the Senate voted that it did want to control enrollments. It said it wanted to control enrollments, but not in such a way that it adversely affected the diversity of our campus.
Oh.
I was happy. I thought that was good,
yeah,
and sound advice. And so one of the tracks that has happened with regard to academic excellence is that we've transformed our student body. And that was a product of that conversation. Because once we said we want to control our enrollments and we got authority to do that, it meant that we were saying to some people they couldn't come, which is never a pleasant thing to do. But as soon as we said to some people they couldn't come, then more people wanted to come. Because this is, yeah, what human beings are like.
Yeah.
And that meant we had to say more people couldn't come, which meant still more people wanted to come. So our applications rose to above 60,000 undergraduate applications.
Oh,
we for this past year were at about 62,000. 3 years ago, when we looked at this, San Diego State was second in the whole country in terms of undergraduate applications. Only UCLA had more than we had. Well, as you get more and more students applying for a limited number of spaces, yeah, not surprisingly, the quality of the students goes up and up and up. So one aspect of the academic quality has been a better prepared student body. Now, I hasten to say that better prepared student body is also a more diverse student body than we had before, and has a greater proportion of low-income students than we had before. So it doesn't fit the stereotypes that people might imagine. But just to follow that line through a little bit, then what happened is the retention of our students went way up. So students weren't dropping out. And then our graduation rates, as they moved through, our graduation rates began to go way up.
Mm-hmm.
The students were taking more credit hours per semester than they had previously. They were more serious about their studies. We were requiring that they complete courses on time and do a whole bunch of things changed. But they changed as our student body got better and more serious about their work.
Yeah.
So that now, and now speaking at the end of this process,
mm-hmm,
San Diego State leads the nation in the improvement in graduation rates. There was an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education about 6 months ago on this matter, and it said that in the last 6 years, our graduation rate has gone up 17 percentage points, which leads the nation, and the number two and three institutions have only gone up 12 percentage points. Most of the nation, incidentally, is going backwards. Graduation rates are going down, not up. So this is really quite remarkable.
That's exciting.
What's even more remarkable, though, is that they were looking only at the last 6 years. If you look at the last 12 years, our graduation rates are up 28 percentage points, and the graduation rate for our students of color is up 31.2 percentage points. This is interesting because you've heard of the achievement gap.
Yes.
We're actually narrowing the achievement gap at San Diego State. We've narrowed it to a point where it's now almost statistically insignificant. But again, the achievement gap is growing around the rest of the country. So this is a big deal. So that's one example of academic excellence. Another thing that happened, and it happened more or less naturally, is universities are always seeking better and better faculty members. That's just a natural process.
Right.
The people that came before me were always seeking better and better faculty. What happens is that typically when a faculty member retires at, you know, at age 65 or 70, they represent the discipline 50 years ago.
Right.
You bring in new people that represent the discipline now. Those retiring faculty are at a point in their career where they're probably not starting new research projects, but those incoming faculty are just beginning their research. So you're trading people with an older view of their profession and less active researchers, and this is obviously generalization, for a newer vision of the discipline and more active researchers. So as we were able to hire more and more people, we've been able to bring wonderful new faculty to San Diego State, and that's meant that our research productivity has gone up. So last year we did $151 million in grants and contracts, for which our faculty have to compete with other people. And in the 15 years I've been here, we've done $1.5 billion in grants and contracts from these really, really good faculty members. These are the sorts of things that speak to the academic excellence of the institution. We're now for the last 4 years, we've been the number one small research university in the country for universities having 14 or fewer PhD programs.
And that's marvelous. I know I was reading something about this as well, stronger SATs, higher increased, as you said, you know, the GPAs, everything.
Yeah.
It's
exactly.
Really wonderful. And honors program swelled.
Well, it did. But again, as your student body changes, they look for different things from the university.
Yeah.
So, of course, the university in turn then begins providing those services.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So, as you mentioned, of course, along with the academic excellence, the goals intertwine with each other. As you said, the diversity was increasing as well. And tell me more about that and social justice.
Well, I'm a creature of the 60s myself, so I was really delighted when the campus said, we care about diversity and social justice. This is something I care a lot about, and we've had we're a diverse place. So, in a certain sense, some diversity just comes with the territory. But we've made some real gains in that diversity. For example, we used to have a model which we characterized, and it's probably not entirely fair, but we characterized it as a revolving door. A lot of our diversity were students that were not very well prepared from not very good high schools, and they were destined to fail. So they came in, they spent a year here, and they flunked out. It was not a good experience for them.
So you were talking about the revolving door and
yes.
RL.
What we've tried to do is replace the revolving door with a corridor to graduation. So we've built lots and lots of programs, 26 as a matter of fact, to help improve our graduation rates and to build a culture of success for those students. We've also reached out beyond the campus in a number of ways. We have a compact for success with the Sweetwater School District, which is in the South Bay of San Diego. It's the oldest.
It's the oldest.
It's the oldest and most diverse secondary school district in the state of California. Secondary meaning grades 7 through 12.
Okay.
And we have basically tripled the college-going rate of the students down there and greatly improved their college preparation. So some of this moves to the notion of social justice, that we move out into the community and give people the opportunities that perhaps have been previously missing for them. And then if they come to San Diego State, great, but if they're prepared and they want to end up at UCLA, well, good for them. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of things of that sort. We also have a program in City Heights called the City Heights Collaborative. City Heights is the poorest community in San Diego. It's only about 2 miles away from our campus. We actually run 3 schools in City Heights, an elementary school, a middle school, and a high school. And among those 3, there are about 5,000 students in those schools. Well, that's another example of social justice and an outreach into the community, a disadvantaged community, mm-hmm. in the case of City Heights, a community that is largely immigrant-based, literally from all over the world. Now, I want to make clear, in many of these things, this is not a matter of charity for us, mm-hmm. or noblesse oblige. This makes us a better university. It gives us wonderful opportunities in terms of how we prepare teachers to prepare them for the realities of today's inner city schools. It gives us research opportunities. It gives us partnerships with issues of public health and community organizing, a whole mm-hmm. range of things. So it's a wonderful synergy, but it taps something that is just deeply resonant in San Diego State, and that is this concept of social justice. I mean, it's one of the things that our campus cared about long before I got here, told me through shared vision they cared about, have continued to pursue going forward.
Very exciting. Very exciting. And as you mentioned, I mean, I can just imagine all the different players who are involved with the schools. And did you have special ways of reaching out to the teachers? And I mean, just
all those things. Well, for example, we first of all, these schools are like charter schools, but they're technically called pilot schools.
Okay.
We were not interested in a hostile takeover, so we said we would only do this with the vote of the teachers.
Okay.
But one of the things we were able to do is, typically inner city schools have some of the least well-credentialed teachers, the youngest teachers, and teachers tend to flee those schools when they have opportunities to go to suburban schools. Well, we've basically reversed that. And we've worked with those teachers to help them get their master's degrees and
be
able to do that on site. So I think at one point we had something like 18 different departments that were on campus that were involved in this project in different ways, because we needed everybody's help.
That's terrific. Yeah. That's just great. Well, proceeding along with the shared goals, Global University Program.
Ah, well, that's another wonderful story. It was not long after Shared Vision that I needed to hire a new provost as our chief academic officer.
Okay.
Now, and this is where this kind of guidance from Shared Vision turned out to be very, very helpful, because I'm looking for the key person for the academic division of the university, and this is a person who's responsible for about 75% of the budgets of the university. So it's a big, big job.
Right.
But I now know what the campus cares about. So I'm able to go out and look for a person that cares about social justice and diversity, that cares about academic excellence, and that cares about internationalization. Let's go back to your question.
Mm-hmm.
So I hired a woman named Nancy Marlin, and she is passionate about internationalization of the campus. And I'll give you some sense of that. This last year, we sent 1,800 students abroad. When Nancy came, I think we sent about 60 students abroad. So completely different world. Completely different world. She has worked with a number of departments that now require an international experience as part of the student's major. She's worked with the students to vote a fee to help provide financial support for students who are studying abroad. Really strong environment of internationalization. Also, we've greatly increased the number of international students studying here.
I was wondering about
that.
Yeah.
So with both of those things. Our students, at the same time, San Diego is a very international place. So I mean, here we are on the rim of the Pacific and the threshold of Latin America. So our students tend to get it. And students who aren't from San Diego but come here, one of the reasons they come here is because we're an international place. So they also care about this. So one of the things that we've seen is the enrollments in our language classes have gone way up. The enrollments in what we call area studies have gone way up. These are international classes. People are interested in learning about Southeast Asia or Latin America or whatever. The transformation with regard to internationalization has been really just extraordinary, and mostly of Nancy's doing. In terms of sending students abroad, we're now second among all the universities in the state of California in sending students abroad, and in the top 20 nationwide in sending students abroad. And as I said, we have a large group, I think about 1,600 international students on campus every year. We also have the largest English as a second language program of any university in the United States. And we have a special program called LARC, which is federally funded, the Language Acquisition Resource Center. Wonderful, wonderful program. This program does a lot of very sophisticated languages, works with languages for the Navy SEALs, for example, does work with the Marines. A lot of, in this current environment, a lot of Middle Eastern languages that are offered. Yeah.
That's fascinating. When you just mentioned Marines, and just struck something else that I had noticed, that there's something I believe that has happened since you're here, to more of a presence of veterans or military.
Yes,
would you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yes, I'm really proud of that. Let me start by saying one of the things that's been very good, and particularly with our current chief diversity officer, a man named Aaron Bruce, is a broad definition of diversity. At some institutions, diversity is equated with the ethnic background of whomever the diversity officer happens to be. Well, not so with Aaron. So he's got a broad sense of what diversity means. And so it includes the LGBT community, and it includes people with disabilities, and it includes immigrants some of the issues that low-income families face, but it also includes veterans. So one of the things that has served San Diego State very well is that we're in San Diego, and we try to reflect San Diego in not all, but much that we do. Here's a case where San Diego is literally the largest military complex in the world. Lots and lots of military muster out here. Right. This is a huge amount of human talent, which we would like to keep in California and in San Diego. So we have now kind of stepped up. We think we have more veterans on campus than any university in the country. This past year it was 1,050 veterans enrolled. Plus we have lots of active duty military, plus lots of dependents. So wide military community here. But the point about this is we really reached out to accomplish this. And one of the keys, which we weren't responsible for, was that the veterans began to come together and organize themselves into a student veterans organization. And a young man named Nathaniel Donnelly led that effort, a former Marine. And this was very helpful because the nature of a university presidency is you talk to lots of people who care about lots of different things and claim to be the voice of lots of different things, but you have no way of knowing whether they speak for other people or not.
Always
so,
an issue.
So,
yeah.
I could have had individual veterans tell me we care about this or we care about that, and it would have been very hard to say, well, I've consulted the veteran community and they think this.
Yeah.
Well, but with a student organization, I could begin to do that. So I wasn't just handpicking the people that I wanted to get whatever advice I wanted, but we now had a group that with which we could work. And they had wonderful leadership, and so we began to work with them to develop a veteran center so that, because we learned from them that one of the things they most missed about the military was the camaraderie. So they needed a place to hang out together. Well, I wouldn't have thought of that. I wouldn't have understood that. But but once I understood it, well, we could do that. Then they told me, you know, we would really like to have some dedicated housing for veterans. Well, that's good. We can do that too. So we did that. In the process, as the veterans helped tell us their needs, and we tried to respond to those needs, we became a national leader in this providing for this new generation of emerging veterans, which meant, of course, that we again had a leadership opportunity, which is what makes it fun to do this, and our university stature grew. That's always nice. So we had more and more opportunities to do things with related to veterans. There is, incidentally, and this happened just as I was coming to San Diego State, we have a war memorial on this campus. There are only two war memorials on campuses west of the Mississippi in the whole country. Well, we happen to have them. We have a very large and active ROTC program here. So a lot of things with regard to the veterans. But then I should add, as people begin to understand the needs of veterans, they were interested in donating to support them. So here again, this becomes a self-reinforcing process of now we have people who, and this is often the case, it's not that they want to give money to support San Diego State. They want to give money to support something, and we're the vehicle through which they can do that.
I see.
So a number of the people that have supported our veterans program are very grateful to San Diego State for what they've done for veterans. But their real point is, and now you've given me a way in which I can support those veterans too.
Very interesting. And tell me, are there more and more women in this veterans group?
Oh, absolutely. Because, in fact, that's one of the things that is different from the Vietnam era. This is an all-volunteer force.
Yeah.
They have all basically got to have a high school diploma to get into the military in the first place. The military is now far more integrated, both racially and in terms of gender, than it was previously. So one of the things that's nice about the military is more integrated racially than most of our society. But its racial diversity pretty much reflects San Diego's. I don't mean with particular groups, but in terms of the proportion of people that are of color. So this is also a very, for people that value the military because it's one of the more racially enlightened organizations in the world, San Diego State is also a very comfortable place for them to come to. So there's just good synergies mm-hmm. between the two. And I should add, the defense industry is a major part of the San Diego economy. Mm-hmm. One of the challenges, and we have a special program called Troops to Engineers. What's happened, I'm generalizing, but what's happened with regard to graduate education in the sciences and in engineering across the country is that more and more of our graduate degrees are being earned by foreign students. And many of those foreign students, of course, are going back to their own countries now.
Right.
Of the ones that stay here and decide that they're going to pursue a career in engineering or something like that, as foreign-born nationals, they often can't get security clearances to work in our defense industry. But our veterans can. So as we begin to get veterans in these fields, they are really sought out by local industry because they're great. I mean, they need the engineers, but they particularly need engineers who can get security clearances to do sensitive work, etc. So it just works very well for everybody.
That's exciting. Well, of course, that also leads into another of your goals, which is resources development.
Well, you know, that's university presidents spend a lot of their time dealing with resources.
And, yeah.
And that means a lot of different things. We've tried to be very careful with the precious dollars that we get. And one way to see that, I want to go back to the graduation rate. We've looked at that changed graduation rate, and we've said if we had our old graduation rate, or when we had our old graduation rate, to produce 100 graduates cost $11.4 million to the state of California. Mm-hmm. Now, what that means is it takes $11.4 million to get to the baccalaureate degree. Well, one of the reasons it costs so much is because, go back to that revolving door, a whole bunch of those students never got to their sophomore year.
I see.
And a whole bunch of folks that you supported for 2 years never got to their junior year. Oh. Now, it costs $6.6 million to produce 100.
Oh, okay.
Well, there's a good use of wise use of
yeah.
resources. Another basic thing is we've done about $700 million in capital construction, major capital projects since I've been here. Only 23% of that has been paid for by the citizens of California. Again, wise use of resources, doing things with other funding sources, etc. And then maybe the best example of this is that we've really changed our environment with regard to philanthropy. Public education in California is late to philanthropy. It used to be against the law, basically, to raise money in California for public universities. So we've got to catch up in this process. But now, we have, when I came, we were raising about $18 million a year. This year, we'll raise $70
million.
So this big difference.
Big.
And the last 3 years, which have been the toughest 3 years for our economy since the Depression, have been our best 3 years ever. So we've changed the culture and the climate. We've raised about $700 million in philanthropy. And to give you a sense of that, that's, and we've done that in the last 15 years, that's three times what we raised in the prior 99 years. So
that's amazing.
That's a big change. All of which is, there are lots of things that go into this. None of these things happen alone.
Clearly.
One of the things that I think is important is San Diego State is not an arrogant university. We will talk with anyone. And we will listen to their concerns. And out of those conversations have come some wonderful new things that we never thought of. A conversation with the biotech industry that led to a program in regulatory affairs. Because they were saying they couldn't get their intellectual product to market because they lacked regulatory affairs professionals to guide that process. So we developed the second master's degree in regulatory affairs in the United States. It wasn't my idea. I didn't even know there was such thing as regulatory affairs. It was the idea of the industry. Same thing with construction engineering management. The construction industry wanted us to help develop that engineering management kind of person who could take complex construction sites and understand both the business and the engineering of them. Maybe the best example, well, another example first, is our hospitals came to us and said, we've got a shortage of nurses. We developed with them a program called Nurses Now that doubled the production of nurses. But the best example, I think, is the hospitality industry. It's the third largest industry in San Diego. And they came to us and they said, we need a school of hospitality. So we developed a school of hospitality. Now, those are all good synergistic conversations.
Yeah.
But I think as we proved ourselves willing to listen and then willing to try to provide these services, the community in turn was willing to support us. Mm-hmm. So it's a virtuous circle in the sense that San Diego State is good at listening, good at trying to respond to the needs of San Diego, and San Diego's been increasingly good about them supporting us in that work.
That's very interesting. And maybe, because I was been reading. Okay. Tell me more about cultivating philanthropists and how that has come about.
Well, it's a major part of my job, and it's also there are lots of jobs in which there are other people in the university that know more than I do and are better prepared to accomplish. But often when you're talking about major gifts, at some point someone has to say, this is important to the university. If somebody's saying, I'd like to give $12 million to San Diego State University because I believe in this, they need the president of the university to say, yes, that's important to us, and yes, we will be sure that the money is spent as you intend. So the university president is kind of the person that gets involved in that. One of the things I like to say, we have a vice president for advancement named Mary Ruth Carlton, and she's very, very good. But for a vice president of advancement, the university president is a tool because she needs that university president to cultivate relations, to ask people for their support, to do all these things. I like to say that for the other vice presidents, the university president is an obstacle. But for this one, for the advancement person, the university president is a tool. The other thing is for the donors, as I said earlier, the university is the tool. You've got the donors that care about veterans. We're the vehicle to do that. Donors that care about increasing the production of nurses. We're the vehicle to do that, et cetera, et cetera. So in this regard, a large part of the job is to develop those relationships. And that's just the value added that a university president can add to the mix that others often aren't in a position to have. I would say there's a part of that, though, that people sometimes don't understand. A university president is the CEO of the organization. Mm-hmm. Well, there are far better and more skillful administrators than I that are out there running the university. So I'm not sitting there with a green visor balancing the budget and hiring everybody and doing all that. Mm-hmm. There are other people that are better at that than I am. A major part of the university president's job is storyteller. That's what the job is. So with regard to philanthropy, part of it is being able to understand the story and then being able to tell it. And that means understanding its history and understanding its successes and failures and its players through time.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in a position to be involved in the community, and the community has been very gracious in letting me be involved in lots of different organizations, so you hear their concerns, and then on the other hand, you understand the talents and the capabilities of the university, you're often in a position to be a matchmaker. And it's not that the matchmaking always works.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it doesn't. But as I said, we're not arrogant. We'll say, and this happens quite frequently, I'll get some people in a room. You bring me your people. I'll bring you some of ours, and we'll sit together for an afternoon. You tell us what you need, and we'll make sure we understand this. Now, it could be that at the end of this discussion,
mm-hmm.
we don't have anybody that's interested in that.
Okay.
Or we don't have anybody that can actually offer anything to them. But then we'll know that.
Mm-hmm.
And if we do have an interest, we'll know that, and we can pursue it. So there's a lot of what the university president does is he hears or she hears community concerns that a lot of my colleagues here who are doing their jobs 70 hours a week, they're not out there to hear those concerns.
Mm-hmm.
So you're a matchmaker.
That's a very interesting perspective and well said.
Do a little, one more thought on the storyteller.
Okay, let me turn it on.
At this moment, we're in the midst of a transition to a new university president. Dr. Elliot Hirschman has been chosen as my successor. Earlier this morning, I was with Elliot. I spent much of yesterday with him. We're doing sort of intensive briefings, putting him together with the vice presidents, doing all this sort of stuff. So he begins to have a context before he assumes his responsibilities in July. Now, we've known this day was coming actually for 4 years, but particularly in the last year, a lot of us at San Diego State have been, you know, engaged in this process, wondering who would emerge as my successor, etc. What I've been saying to people during that year is that they often don't understand what the president actually does. In fact, if the president does his or her work well, it just frees them to do their work, so they don't have to know what. But what I've been saying to them is that, in fact, the major job is the job of storyteller. And so the risk to the university as you change presidents is not that now the finances are not going to be handled and the budgets aren't going to be balanced. No, of course not, because other people do that anyways. And it's not that all of a sudden great faculty won't be hired or good students won't be admitted. No, no, university president doesn't really do any of that stuff. The danger is that you lose your storyteller. That's the danger. You're exposed for a while without a storyteller. So what I've been saying for the last year to people at San Diego State is take this occasion to actually think about the story.
Mm-hmm.
Internalize it for yourself, because there's no one story. So you figure out what you think the story is and then share it with Elliot. And Elliot will absorb all those stories, and then he's going to create his own interpretation of those mm-hmm. stories, and then you'll empower him to resume the job of the president, and that is to be able to tell the story. It's a very good and healthy process, and it's been a good experience for the whole campus.
It's marvelous.
You want to talk about the state of California?
If you do.
sure. I need to start by saying the state of California is absolutely extraordinary place. I came here from New York,
Right.
The greatness of New York 100 years ago was that it was a node through which the United States interacted with Europe.
Right.
And it was a wonderful relationship there. Well, the fact is now the world is being invented around the Pacific and not the Atlantic. And California is the emerging node through which the United States is going to be related to or is relating itself to the Pacific. California at one point was, I think, the seventh largest economy in the world. It attracts all sorts of invention and new ideas, the Silicon Valleys. In our case in San Diego, the wireless industry lives here, the biotech industry.
Right.
California is about the future. And, you know, as an Easterner, I'm sad to say it's about the past. It's great past, it's a wonderful past, but by and large, the future is going to be invented in the West.
Mm-hmm.
There's an interesting fact about that that goes back to a little bit what I was saying earlier. 3 years ago, the number 10 university in the country for undergraduate applications was Arizona State. The top nine in the country are all in the state of California.
Mm.
Now think of that. I mean, here we're talking about a world in which prosperity is going to be equated to brain power, and California, top nine applications in the country. Of the top nine, eight are in Southern California, and of the top five, two are in San Diego. San Diego State was number two, UCSD was number five. This is the good news of California.
Yes.
This is the wonderful news of California. The other thing about California is the diversity of California, which leads the diversity of our country. I mean, that is, as the country becomes increasingly diverse, California is the example of that diversity. Mm-hmm. And it's figuring out how to be a diverse society in ways that the rest of the country will benefit from and will learn, just as California is leading on issues of environmental quality. California sort of figures it out, the rest of the country mirrors it. So it's good to be a part of a leader in that sense. Then when you look back at California in the 60s, it was an extraordinary place in terms of education. Its schools were always in the top five, and I mean by schools it's K through 12.
Yeah, I remember.
Among the states in the country.
Right.
Now California is always among the bottom five.
How did that happen?
California gave up on funding itself. I think a lot of that was Prop 13. There's a wonderful book called Paradise Now. It came out not long after I came to California by an author named Peter Schreck, who's with the Sacramento Bee, wonderful education reporter. And this book really, I was really interested in this book because I was eager to get as much information as I could about California.
Yeah.
The Paradise Lost, of course, is referencing Milton's title, but the paradise that has been lost is California that he's talking about. And he traces much of that to Prop 13. He also traces much of it to the supermajorities, which, and these are my words, not his, but which he sees as a desperately cynical measure to preserve white hegemony against the changing demographics. And a basically successful ploy that postponed the transfer of power for one, maybe two generations.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, serious stuff. Okay. But what you've got now is a state that can't afford to invest in its own citizens, that is more interested in its prisons than it's in its universities. I like to say, as a philosopher, mm-hmm. when I was studying philosophy, there's a seminal book called Five Stages of Greek Religion by Gilbert Murray. Wonderful book. And it's saying, how on earth did we lose this wonderful system of Greek religion to these upstart Christians? I mean, what happened there? How on earth would, you know, a couple folks in Jerusalem knock over Athens in ancient Greece? That just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Well, but his answer is, it was a failure of nerve. Very interesting. And so what he's really saying is that whole Greek society and concept and culture lost its nerve.
Huh.
It's a very interesting hypothesis. So I keep saying to myself, okay, what is it? How did California blow this this opportunity?
Yeah.
And my answer is, it's not a failure of nerve. It's a triumph of selfishness.
Ah.
That's exactly what Prop 13 is.
Ah, yes.
Is a triumph of selfishness.
Yeah.
But it's also what we've done in a society that has spent huge amounts of money on its own consumer satisfaction and denied those resources to the next generation and to its schools, etc.
Right.
So I think California has, of all the parts of the United States, the best opportunity to have a future.
Mm-hmm.
But at the moment, at least, it is more interested in indulging its creature comforts than sacrificing for that future. One of the most basic animal prerogatives is the idea that you sacrifice yourself for the next generation. There's very little evidence we're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
There's little evidence we're even capable of that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other people, and the good news is there are other people who are. They're in China, they're in India.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's not a human tragedy, because the human process will go on.
Yeah.
It's just that we've pretty much given up on a desire to lead it.
Hmm. Talk about that?
Sure.
Okay, let me put it on. Should I ask that question? Okay. Do you see yourself in a way as a politician as well as a storyteller?
Absolutely. There's no way around the fact that a university president isn't going to be able to serve his or her university well and be tone deaf. So you have to pay attention to these issues. There's a wonderful story that I won't have exactly right, but you remember that Woodrow Wilson had been the president of Princeton.
Right.
When people said, you know, what's a university president doing running the free world? He said, I learned politics at Princeton. That's right. Universities are highly political organizations. There's a cliche which isn't true. I don't agree with it, but it's a telling line nonetheless, and that is that in universities the political fights are so fierce because the stakes are so small.
Huh.
Now that's not true, but the concept is they are fierce. These are people that care deeply about their work. They're competing for scarce resources. It's almost the definition of a political environment.
Right.
But then, in a public university, you're, of course, funded by the citizens of California. So you are literally working with your representatives and with legislators to deal with those things. So a major part of the challenge of a university president is to engage in a political environment in a way that is not, well, there are some exceptions, but I've always thought in a way that it is not partisan, but is capable of working with changing constituencies and changing alliances on both sides of the aisle to advance the interests of the organization. So, and I should add another thing, that is, since the legislature and to some degree the Congress controls part of your resources.
Right.
It means you're spending time in Sacramento. You're spending time in Washington. You know all these people. You work with them regularly. You're trying to solicit their help for different projects. On the other hand, they're trying to solicit your help for projects of theirs. So it's a highly political environment, and I don't mean anything negative by that.
Right.
It bothers me that politics have begun to have a negative connotation. I mean, this is a great example of the people's business, and folks are attending to that. And I should say that almost, not completely, but almost without exception, the public servants with whom I've worked in the city of San Diego and the state of California and across the United States have been very good, decent people trying to accomplish good things for the people they serve.
Mm-hmm.
There are jerks, but they're more or less the normal distribution of jerks that you find in any other human society.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Do that, because I think that's such a change.
Yeah.
Would you talk a bit about, over the years that you've been here, the change and the opportunities to use new kinds of media as you are doing what you do?
First of all, that's a very perceptive question, because it's absolutely critical, and there are so many ways in which we could talk about that. But remember that universities are environments in which the faculty members are inventing those new communication technologies, and the students are early adopters of those new communication technologies. So you've got to not only keep up, but you've got to be ahead of the game, and it evolves all the time. I would also say that if you go back to that earlier statement that the university president is the storyteller, you've got to tell that story now on multiple platforms. You can't. You know, there was a time when the university president, as storyteller, the only thing that really meant was that maybe the university president would retire and go write a history of the campus.
Right.
Well, now that's, no. So let me give you, first of all, an example of that, and then I want to come back to the broader question. When I was in school, to register for a course meant standing in line.
Right.
You'd work your way to the end of the line, only to find out the course was now full and you couldn't go. You got to go stand in another line. Then there was a period where you still had to stand in the line, but you now did it with computer cards. And so you'd have a card, and you'd have they'd give you a card for the course then, and you'd register that way. Well, then the next big advance was that you could register by phone. Now this is I won't know the dates of this exactly, but I'm guessing in the 80s we began registering students by phone. Wonderful advance. So you could touch tone in and you could say this is great. Okay. Then we began registering online. So while before you were registering by phone, but what if you were in Tuscany? Well, tough luck. But now, registering online doesn't matter. You're anywhere in the world, now you can do that. Now, the latest thing is through the web portal. And what that means now is our students, when you registered by phone, for example, by registering, what you did is you said you'd like to have that course.
Mm-hmm.
But they had to get back to you then and find out whether you got the course. Now you have your own dedicated web portal. You log on. You, Susan, are the only person that can have this portal. It shows you only the courses that are open, so you don't have to shop through them. It shows you only the courses you're eligible for, so it's not going to show you the upper division physics courses that you couldn't register for. And when you touch the screen, you are enrolled in the course. It's instantaneous. So, completely different world. Absolutely completely different world. Now, that's just with regard to registration for courses. The same thing has happened Now let's start in more traditional sense of storytelling. It used to be that universities would have a university publication of some sort, a magazine.
Right.
Well, actually, I should start. The old thing used to be a university catalog. Remember those big, thick catalogs?
Sure.
We don't have university catalogs anymore. They're all online. You get all this information. But back to the magazines. Now, your magazines are electronic. More and more of them aren't printed at all, or they're printed in very limited editions. They're electronic. There are all sorts of web publications, Facebook, Twitter, social media. We have a dedicated professional in university relations who's a social media specialist. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful vehicle for communicating with people. So this has changed a lot, and I should add, in the case of San Diego State, we also have a wonderful research tool in KPBS, which is our public broadcasting station. KPBS is one of the top 10 stations in the country, both on radio and in television. And part of where KPBS is now leading a national trend towards multi-platform broadcasting. So you'll see now they're driving stories not only broadcast, but through their website and other things, being able to do follow-up stories, expanded stories on the web that you've got the information, but previously mm-hmm. you didn't have a way to share it. So the world of communications is evolving very, very fast, and because you have such a sophisticated audience, they just demand that you be up to date on those things. And there's no end in sight. It's going to get faster and faster.
But it's also such a marvelous opportunity for you to, as the president, to get across messages to such a wide range of audiences.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. In fact, it's normally that's exactly what it is. And you remember the old cliche that you should never start an argument with somebody that buys ink by the barrel. Well, you know, that used to be true.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, it was hard to pick a fight with a newspaper because they were going to have the last word.
Yeah.
And even when they were completely wrong and misinformed, you were dependent upon them to make the correction, which they would make in a little box on page 4. And well, now, if it's serious, I can reach out to 200,000 people with the truth of the story. That changes the whole relationship. That means now, and it's not as if the newspaper doesn't understand that.
Yeah.
So it has made that relationship a more honest relationship, in which the newspaper tends to be far more eager to get the facts right because they don't want us correcting it. So you end up with a situation, and you'll see this often now with a story that has a serious factual error in it. You know, we will notify the newspaper right away, and they will change their web posting of the story immediately. Well, that wasn't true 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
Well, but one of the reasons they're so responsive is not only because they would rather get the story correct, as they would, but they also know if they don't set the record straight, we will, and they'd rather them not be publicly on the wrong side of the facts.
Yeah. Speaking of stories, okay, I'll turn on. Share a story with us.
Well, let me. When we were talking about shared vision, as I came to San Diego State, the shared vision process began in the fall. Actually, we began talking about it in the fall, and the process began the following spring because it took a lot of planning, as I said before. But I came in early July. I think my first day was July 5th. The campus was extraordinarily open and welcoming. and constructive in I think both wanting us to succeed and trying to help us figure out how to succeed. But one of the most extraordinary things in the history of the university then happened soon afterwards, and that is three of our faculty members were murdered on campus by a graduate student who was taking his oral examination for his master's degree, a student in engineering. And this was, as you could imagine, an absolutely horrid moment. Oh. I was so new that my colleagues were concerned that I didn't, that I would think this was business as usual. and of course, so they hastened to assure me that this had never happened before, and of course it's never happened since. But these were three young faculty members in the College of Engineering at the outset of very promising careers. A master's student who was obviously distraught secreted a gun in the conference room. There were actually students in the room as well as observers, but literally murdered the three faculty members. An extraordinarily heroic police officer ended up, one of our public safety officers, ended up facing this man in a corridor with a loaded gun, having just killed three people, and was able to get him to drop that gun and capture him. This was an absolutely traumatic moment, not only for those families and those colleagues, but also for the whole university.
Oh yeah.
And it happened on the last day of the Republican convention, which happened to be in town. Mm-hmm. Well, that meant that the national press were all here. And so the national press were all on campus.
Yeah.
Now as a new university president, you don't get to deal with the situations. You just have to deal with the situations you're given. you don't get to choose them. So here's a terrible, terrible situation. But one of the things that came out of this that was remarkably positive is that, I know this is a stereotype, but engineers tend to be very much concentrated on their work and not terribly engaged in the rest of the campus. It is a stereotype, but there's some truth to that. And so the engineers were surprised that the whole campus was distraught by this. You know, they didn't see their image of their role and their relationship to San Diego State was not such that everyone else would be aggrieved. So there was a very interesting lesson for the whole campus of this about how unified we actually were, that emerged from this tragedy.
Yeah.
And it was an important lesson. You know, it's not a lesson we sought or wanted, but the truth is, everybody kind of stepped back and said, "Oh my, we care about those three engineers and their families and their children, but they probably care about the rest of us too." It's a very seminal moment in the history of the university that to this day, as I'm leaving, when people talk about things in the last 15 years that they want to recognize as having shared together, that's one of the ones that comes up.
And that was at the very beginning, my goodness.
Yeah, I think maybe 6 weeks, something like that.
Do you recall having been interviewed at that time by the press?
Sure. All that sort of thing. But That's not what I recall about them. What I recall is the time with the widows and, uh-huh. and with their little kids on their living room rugs and being in one of the houses as they brought back the personal effects of the husband. You know, that those are just terrible. Going to the memorial services and the real empathy that the rest of the campus felt towards these young families. It was, in that sense, it was a it was obviously an extraordinary moment, but it was a very moving one.
Yeah. As you are now where you are and we're reflecting back, are there any other major events or moments that jump out at you?
Yeah, there are. There are lots of events that come out that call for the university to speak to, you know, and this is a good example of if I had been a faculty member in the philosophy department, I'd like to believe that I would have been shocked by this tragedy, and I would have cared about it, and I might have written a note to the widows. But if you're the president of the university, you've actually got to say something about it.
Right.
And that's really part of the difference. I mean, you now have to find the voice of the university, and you can't presume that your own views are the voice of the university. So you've got to look for a voice that resonates with the people whose feelings you're articulating, and that's always a delicate process. Another example of that happened only a couple years ago is we had a huge drug bust on campus that, you know, we had worked very closely with and cooperated with the FBI and things like that. But there again, as the university president, you have to stand in front of the cameras,
right,
and articulate the university's values and make decisions about how to tell what's going to happen to these young people and what the consequences are for the university.
Yeah.
And deal with people whose understanding of San Diego State is tangential. So, mm-hmm. so all of a sudden, there's a danger that they're going to equate your university with this one event.
Right.
Whether the one event is the murder of the engineers, or the drug bust,
right,
or fill in, you know, any number of other things. And a large part of the process is to find a way to return to what the university actually is and put this in some context against what the university actually is, and do it in a way that both responds to the public appetite to understand it, which is fair enough and legitimate, and the university's desire that you speak the truth in a way that actually they can recognize it as the truth.
So I'll just say at this juncture, okay. At this juncture, tell me about, as you're embarking on a new adventure, retirement, talk to me a little about what you're thinking about.
Well, let me start by what I used to think about. When I was a young man, I assumed I would retire at age 65. And pretty much everybody in our society did assume that.
That's right.
Time. So it was not as if there was any thought behind it. It was just what everybody assumed. As I approached age 65, I was healthy. I was having a good time. And my colleagues said, you ought to stay. You shouldn't retire now. And Susan and I discussed that, and it brought us to kind of changing our mind about this and saying, yeah, why, we ought to stay. When university presidents retire, one of the things that they do is they go off to be interim presidents at other universities. Mm-hmm. And I was saying to myself, well, why would I want to be an interim president at a university I don't care about, mm-hmm. when I can be the president at a university I do care about? So we thought about this for a while, and we said, yes, we'd like to stay a little bit longer. But then the next thought I had was, well, I don't want people wondering, when is he going to leave? So we said, let's agree to do 4 more years, and I will announce it to the university so everybody's clear about it. Uh-huh. So 4 years ago I said, I'll stay until 2011. Now, that's contrary to all the management gobbledygook about being a lame duck and things like that. It turned out to be a very, very good thing to do. It served the university well because it's a very orderly transition. Everybody knew it was out there. They knew when it was coming. So it turned out, I think, to serve us all very well. So when I now look at the actual retirement, and as you and I speak, I will my last day in the office will be in a week. My last official day will be July 5th, but I'll take some vacation between my last day in the office and July 5th. So I'll soon be leaving. And the first thing I would say is, it is a new adventure, and I'm ready for a new adventure. And you use that word, and it's the right word. I'll have been here for 15 years, and I did a university presidency before this one. So I've been a university president for 23 years. That's a long time in the scheme of things. So I'm ready to do something else. But people often say, you know, what are your plans for retirement? It is something you can talk about, obviously. Yeah. And I've come to say, you know, you asked the question the right way, because they're only plans, and I've never retired before, so I don't really know. Yeah. You know, that's what makes it an adventure.
Yes. Yes.
So what I think is that, well, I know we're going to move to Maine, where we have a home that we built about 30 years ago. That home has served as home base for us for a long time. We built it shortly after we left the University of Maine. We were living in Connecticut then. But as we moved around the country to different jobs, that's actually been the home base. And even before we had that home, Maine was where our first young professional friendships were formed. It's where our kids were born. Mm-hmm. It is, as I said, a place that we return to every summer. And, mm-hmm. So that's part of what we see in our retirement. I like to do woodworking, so I'm going to be doing woodworking. I'm going to be writing. Susan and I enjoy gardening. We'll be doing gardening. I like to kayak, and we're right there where I'll be kayaking. So we'll do the things in our retirement that most people imagine doing in their retirement. Our expectation is that we will leave Maine around Thanksgiving time every year and go travel to a warmer mm-hmm. place. Mm-hmm. This year we're going to Dunedin on the South Island of New Zealand for December and January. And then we'll come back to San Diego for February and March. We've rented a condo in Solana Beach. And then we'll go back to Maine in the spring and get the gardens going and do things like that. So that's what we imagine for our retirement. Uh-huh. We've got some a a couple boards that I'm going to serve on that I just care about what they do, and I'll continue to be involved in some things like that. But as I say to people, you know, I'm 69 years old, and it's a good time for somebody else to come in and start asking new questions at San Diego State.
Okay. It's relatively cogent. Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing this oral history with me, and it'll be with a lot of other people, fortunately, because of the new communication that we have online. And clearly, you are not only a storyteller, but you're a very active listener and a leader, and it's just been a pleasure for me to conduct this interview. Thank you.